All right, it's 11:55. We might get started. So welcome to the session, Numbers Speak Louder Than Words, presented by Eric Ranson. My name is Jason Sun, and I work in the actuarial space and actuarial consulting space, and I will be your chair. Following Eric's presentation, there will be Q&A. Please use the app or speak into the microphone in the middle of the room to ask questions. Eric has said to me that he's very open to discussion and challenge, so looking forward to some good questions. Eric Ranson has had an impressive career journey, spanning roles including consulting actuary, fund manager, treasurer, investment banker, financial advisor, and entrepreneur. He is currently developing volcanic ash to improve concrete in Australia and make it greener. Over the past 8 years, his business Seed Change has helped startups access over $7 million of government support to grow to business valuations of over $300 million. The topic Numbers Speak Louder Than Words explores effective communication through numbers, words, and pictures. The theory will be applied in an investment context with case studies on retirement income, residential mortgages, and asset markets. Personally, when it comes to effective communication, I find statements like the 7-10 rule very interesting. If you haven't heard of it before, it goes, if you receive 7% compounded growth over 10 years, you double your asset value, and vice versa with 10% over 7 years. So I'm very excited to see what Eric has in store. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you all for coming along, and it's nice and intimate, and do feel free to put your hand up or stop me if you want to ask questions. I think I'm just generally trying to keep things as simple as I can, and the concepts are reasonably simple. So, my goal here is to ask for your criticism and feedback, and then ultimately, if you kind of feel like you're on my side for your support, so I do want to engage as much as possible, as Jason said. I've spent a lot of time thinking about how financial services could be done better, and I think we don't necessarily think of it as actuaries, but I've tried to tie it into what actuaries do and what actuaries have learned. We work from our 20s through to our 60s, and in that period we're trying to build up a retirement nest egg, and we're probably trying to buy a house and pay that off. So basically the two main financial services are superannuation and mortgages. And I've got problems with both of them, and I'll explain why I think we can double retirement incomes without any major changes. Well, with major changes, but without any detrimental changes. And how mortgages could have minimum repayments that were 30% lower, which in a time when everyone's complaining about affordability and the problem with paying for mortgages is not insignificant. Presenting's a journey for me. When you come to put in an abstract, which is, at the start of this year, 6 months ago, for me it's just a few ideas and trying to work out what I was trying to say with those ideas. When it comes to preparing the slides is when I guess the tires hit the gravel. And so I kind of started writing ideas down. But I originally started with the idea of trying to work out what all these conference themes that we have every year or every 2 years for actuarial conferences were all about. And it always seemed to me that they're all always grandiose and trying to work out how we could be, changing the world. And then it always seemed when I went to the conference that nobody's trying to change the world. And I was trying to kind of put all that together. So in the end, yeah, my starting point is trying to match conference themes with messaging at the end there. And then I realized that, there's probably some steps along the way. And what I'm attracted to is adding value. And what I came up with for this sort of slide session, and again, the slides were 2 weeks ago, so, you know, what I say has probably got nothing much to do with what I was thinking when I was doing the slides. So it is a journey. But yes, I've come up with some insights thought that they link things nicely. And yeah, my feelings about presentations is if you come up with one decent insight, then you've probably justified your time there. So anyway, let's move on. Oh yes, before we move on, can't walk away from the title of the original abstract, which is Numbers Speak Louder Than Words. So I guess this was my original thinking, was if a message is pitched at the same level of clarity or with the same confidence and the numbers change, the impact of those numbers gets higher and higher and keeps on getting higher as you go from 50% to 70% to 90% to 99% to 99.9%. It keeps on going up. But if the numbers are the same, you won 51% of the vote, for example, and the message changes or the clarity of the message changes, yeah, sure, I got 51% of the vote, so I'm a winner. It was a big win. I got 51% of the vote. It was a fantastic win, the best win that our side of politics has had for a long time. And then at some point you get to, this is the greatest win we've ever had in the history of American politics. Sorry. Might have been obvious I was going to Trump's win in the recent election. But at some point that, messaging actually loses impact. So that was part of my justification for why numbers speak louder than words. But moving on to insights, and if I had my time again, I'd change the title from Numbers Speak Louder than Words to The Theory of Financial Relativity. So the one biggest insight I think that I've come away with from the actuarial course is that real returns are both more stable and more predictable than absolute returns. And that's a pretty simple statement. It's not mind-blowing. But it is actually pretty important when we go back to the core of financial services being mortgages, retirement savings. And I've tried to sort of break down what I think are three of the big things that you can deduce from that. Simple thing. And that's that retirement income planning would be much better if it used real assets. And I'll go through that example. In the end, communication's pretty important. So I think it's too easy to lose people along the way, and hopefully that example deals with that. As I said, real mortgages can, changing the structure of mortgages, potentially we can reduce the initial repayments on mortgages, and by doing so, create better outcomes for, I think, both lenders and borrowers. And yes, the ultimate conclusion and the real thing I guess we're I'm trying to say is that borrowers generally borrow money to invest in real assets, whether it's a machine to make coffee or a machine to dig pozzolan or volcanic ash out of the ground to sell. So basically, your returns out of most of the things you're borrowing for are real returns. They'll probably grow over time. And in my mind, it makes a lot of sense if your repayments on the loans that you use to buy those sort of assets grow over time. So just talking about what is the best way to tell somebody who has just started working about their retirement income, I wanted to compare what people do and what I think they should do. So I think what we normally do is we take somebody who's in their 20s and project for 40-odd years what their retirement balance will be. And I just did an example with some reasonable numbers. They're probably high, 90,000 income, which I think is the average income, not the average income for somebody who's starting work. But come out with a number of 5.2 million. We're all good at doing the calculations. So I'm sure you understand the method I used to get to something like that. And what do retirement planners tell people? Well, yes, you'll have 5.2 million. And people naturally ask, well, is that going to be enough? And the retirement planner will probably say, it depends. And then there might be some discussion on different investment strategies. There might be some discussion on how you draw down that amount. But basically, the problem that is most likely going to emerge is that the financial literacy of somebody who's going to see the financial planner won't be sufficient for that person to understand everything. So I guess it's good, because then the clients rely on the financial planner to do everything: investment strategy, contribution rates, recommendations, and all sorts of additional contributions and things like that. I guess what I'd like to see is a movement to just saying, well, let's use the fact that we've got a real interest rate, which is more predictable and means that we can do a simple model that comes up with a real income in retirement. And I've put it in terms of income. In my model, is basically just an annuity factor to convert that income to a retirement balance. And I guess the retirement balance would be about 20 times, so 1.3 million in real dollars. And if you give somebody a retirement income, and it could also be a range, so you could say it was 60,000 to 70,000, and that range could depend on the level of risk in your asset selection. So very safe assets could give you a small range, but basically, yeah, the main point is that people in society are expected to earn an income and balance their budget or work with that income, and they can do it. So if you tell them that in retirement, where we're heading for is this income, so you're just moving from a 90,000 income while you're working to a $65,000 income in retirement, people can get that and understand it and work with it. And if you say, do you want to put in additional contributions, they can understand why they might do that. Which is, I think, a little bit better than creating the discussion about whether 5.2 million is a sufficient retirement savings balance in 40 years' time. So getting down to mortgages, I guess, yeah, I've already alluded to it. How should you assess financial capacity to repay a mortgage? So I guess the way they do it now is they say, what's your income and what are your expenses? And so, well, let's try and work out what your financial capacity is. But essentially they're saying, if you have that financial capacity for the next 30 years, then we can calculate a mortgage for you. But really, over the next 30 years, people are either going to get a promotion, get sacked from their job, or get regular increases to in line with inflation. So they're not going to have a stable repayment capacity, or an absolute repayment capacity. They're going to have a real repayment capacity. So it seems to me far more logical to assess the mortgage on a real basis. And the one easy way to do that is to have a real mortgage instead of a mortgage that we've got at the moment. I've got the variable mortgage, assuming everyone does that. But what does that mean? It means that instead of paying 6% on your mortgage, which is variable, we just have a 30-year CPI index mortgage at 3%. And the 3% will have slightly higher principal repayments implied. But obviously it starts off with a lower repayment in, because most of the repayment is the interest component. So just to put a few numbers down there, there's basically a 30% saving on your initial repayment. Obviously over time, as the principal is inflated, that repayment will go up, and the way I've done this is to say, well, there's no difference in the profitability of that mortgage contract. So basically it's the same mortgage contract. But I mean, the other way of looking at it is that you've increased your capacity by 40%, and I guess there's potential to argue about how much people should be borrowing. But if somebody is coming out of or starting their working career on a $90,000 salary, and we can expect that to go up with inflation, then arguably they should be able to purchase a property that fits their ability to repay for the next 30 years. If you use the current system and constrain their mortgage amount, then they're going to be in the situation which we often see, which is that people buy a cheaper house, get their repayments going, and maybe get a few pay rises and maybe even some promotions, and then they move into a slightly better house over time. So yes, very keen to hear anybody's thoughts about whether that could be a better way to go for a standard mortgage product. And yeah, I'm pretty interested in thinking about who could offer it, because I'm a bit negative about the providers of mortgages, which is the main banks, because I feel like the government underwrites them. So basically the government's got a guarantee on bank deposits, which is, I think, close to two trillion of bank deposits, government guaranteed. So everyone can go and deposit in banks. What do the banks do with that money? They lend it out on mortgages. But that's a 30-year asset. Oh, don't worry, the government will guarantee liquidity on your mortgages, so via the Reserve Bank. So the government's basically underwriting a 2% spread on monies for banks, which is, depending on how you work it, 40 billion a year of underwritten profits. And obviously there's some transaction costs for banks to run mortgages, but I do have a feeling that if the government set up a deposit taking facility and started doing real mortgages, they could basically add 40 or 50 billion to the bottom line, to the government's bottom line, even if they outsourced the management of those mortgages and the deposits. I mean, the deposit's pretty simple thing to manage online. So yes, I think mortgages is a great opportunity to add value on assets. In the same way, and I've already discussed it, as people's incomes go up over time, if you buy productive assets, the revenue is expected to go up over time. And on the other hand, if you're an investor, you know, why are you investing? Because you want to spend money. And so over time, the cost of your expenditure is going to go up. So it seems to me a bit crazy that financial markets aren't dominated by inflation-linked assets and liabilities, because ultimately that's what both sides of the equation primarily need. It's just that banks in their wisdom and the financial services market in general have just said, oh, well, if you want to borrow some money, we'll charge you 6% or some absolute number. And in some ways it is simpler because you don't have to write in some contract adjusted by CPI defined as this and that. But I think if people were serious and motivated, they could easily make those sort of adjustments. Yes, let's get down to portfolio theory. I imagine that most of the superannuation investment strategies that are recommended to people out there come from a starting point a long time ago of portfolio theory, saying, well, if you get a diversification of assets, you'll increase your expected return or maximize your expected return for a certain level of risk, and we'll just adjust the level of risk to change the portfolios to fit in with that. But I think there's been some problems. I don't hear about portfolio theory anymore, and I think that there are some issues in that it seems that assets have become far more correlated over time. And I've kind of got a theory that assets haven't been properly identified for portfolio theory to work at its best. So before I go there, the first thing that I want to say is that I've created a portfolio theory model. I've said, okay, here's your standard superannuation product. If we add an extra asset class, which is inflation-linked assets that are reasonably safe and inflation-linked, and we make the target of that portfolio model to be a real return, so real assets become the safe assets, and fixed interest assets, even if they're relatively safe in absolute terms, aren't necessarily purely safe in terms of in real terms. But on my model, you get almost a 1% increase in return for the same risk by adding that real asset. So in my mind, adding real assets adds an awful lot of value, because if you start off with our original example of somebody earning $5 million and you add 1% per annum for the 40 odd years that they're saving up for that, it basically doubles that to 10 million. So potentially you're doubling your retirement income just by adding 1%. And I guess we've all seen numbers about the big difference that small increments in return can make. But going a little bit beyond that broader thoughts on asset allocation and portfolio theory. I mean, I have the feeling that shares, which are put out there as real assets, but really they've got a inflation component. They've got a component which is wanting to get a return on your capital, a fixed return on your capital, and then they've got a risk component which is depending on the particular share and that sort of stuff. And then when you look at property, again, it's got a very large inflation component, and then there's some specific property risks. And so if you add in a relatively safe inflation-linked mortgage or something like that, again, it's got a very large inflation component. So if I was going to do portfolio theory and come up with a retirement income, I'd be rejigging my shares and property and making them into partly inflation component and coming up with a very different way of looking at portfolio management. I suspect if I did that, I'd still come out with, I mean, my model sort of said should have 30% or so of inflation-linked assets, safe inflation-linked assets. I think you'd still come out with a broadly similar breakup. It's just that you'd have this big inflation component, which would be probably 70% or something like that, and then you'd be adding risky share component, risky property component, and maybe a tiny bit of cash or something like that. So apart from adding a large proportion of inflation-linked assets, it probably wouldn't change the superannuation investment standard greatly. But I think those were the kind of main points that I was going to make. So I am keen to hear any feedback or any questions or any criticisms. So I'm ready to open the floor.
All right. Thanks, Eric, for that very, very interesting presentation. So I'm going to put it out there. So with say, property investment, and if you increase, if you decrease the minimum payment, so everyday people can access more borrowing to buy houses. There's a housing affordability issue or accessibility issue at the moment that might increase demand and therefore might increase housing prices. Do you think, and obviously there's a lot that you can play with, whether it's kind of the demand side or supply side with housing. Do you think that's, what's your opinion on the appropriateness of that solution? Do you think that's the best way? Is there a better way?
No, I mean, a fantastic question. And I think the question is more about the state of the property market than what I'm talking about. So what I'm talking about is at any point in the property cycle, I think it's more appropriate to assess people's ability to repay mortgages on the real basis rather than on the absolute basis or based on their current income. And yes, our particular issues in property at the moment are more around the property cycle. There's arguments if you increase the value of property, eventually somebody will start making more of it. But I think it's appalling. One thing you can say about reducing the minimum repayments is that potentially it creates a tiny bit more risk because you're pushing out the repayment profile, and so maybe instead of 80% of LVRs for mortgages, banks had moved to 75% LVRs. But I mean, another thing you can say is that if the government took over that section of the mortgage market, I mean, basically the government's the ultimate provider of housing. So if people lose their jobs, the government comes in with housing support and supports the stuff anyway. So if the government creates more affordable mortgages and stuff like that, it's got less support that it needs to do over time. So there's an awful lot of things going on if you start talking about all the parts of the property market. I spent a bit of time working with some people who wanted to do another thing which might exacerbate the price of property, which was to split property up into the land component and the house component, which I think is a great idea, and I think I might have talked about it in previous conferences. But basically, these days, property prices are so high that there's basically an element of investment in it. And again, you could have a very safe real asset, which was the land, and basically, while ever the land was being paid a CPI indexed income for the next 300 years or whatever, the land owner did nothing, didn't participate. So the leaseholder basically owned the property, but instead of paying $1 million for it, they only had to come up with $600,000 for it, and they're just renting the land component. So that ultimately probably pushes up prices a tiny bit, but yes, instead of $600,000, maybe they have to pay $650,000. There's a lot of things going along with property, but yes, what I'm talking about is just a long-term thing that you do regardless of the cycles.
Yes. Yes.
Thanks, Eric, for your paper. What you're saying reminds me of something in my experience, but back in the 1970s and 80s, the state governments in various states decided it would be a good idea to try and get low-income people off the housing, public housing list, and devised a number of these loans similar to what you're describing, real interest rate loans, so that, and as you say, that it, you know, 40% less repayments that enabled people on very low incomes to take out mortgage loans, which sounded a great idea in theory, but because it was run by the government, it wasn't a great idea in fact. And I was actually called in at one stage to investigate and report on it, so I know a bit about what happened. I mean, because they were low-income people, their incomes didn't go up much. And so the whole idea of a real increase in income over time, which is a good idea for the average, doesn't necessarily apply to the individual. And of course, the other thing is that they tried to run these mortgages the same way that banks run the existing mortgages. And what I discovered, which I'd never really thought about, is that one of the reasons why banks are very attracted by fixed dollar mortgages is that they really don't need to check the LVR more than at the time of inception, because as people's income will always go up in some way, unless they're the unfortunate lot who lose their job. If the loan is covered by the asset at inception, it always will be. Whereas when you go down to a real mortgage, you've got to be continually checking whether the person's income has in fact gone up by more than inflation. And so, I mean, that's not to say that these things can't work, but they require a totally different way of thinking, which, especially if you have a government doing it out of goodwill without any sense of the realities of the market, that can be rather hazardous.
Yes. Thank you for the question, and I think it's a great observation. Basically, humans will find a way to stuff things up, no matter how good the idea was to start with. But my recollection of those schemes was that they actually suppressed the payments for the first few years with the idea that these people would eventually get jobs by putting them in housing and then they're in better place, then they get jobs and they increase their income. I think generally those very low income people on government benefits are continuing to increase with inflation. But I think that those mortgages weren't judged on the government income alone. I thought there was an assumption that they went to a higher level. And yes, I mean, back in those days, the government stuffed up monumentally with American-style mortgages for a while, fixed rate, and some of my thinking is around the or comes back on and leans on the idea that there is a relatively stable interest inflation gap over time. Obviously, having a inflation linked mortgage that has a plus 3% or plus 2% kind of spread on it means that part of the mortgage is actually fixed. But you're hoping that that plus 2% return on your mortgage is something that you know, is reasonably stable over time, and I'd have them so that instead of being variable interest rate, it's still got that capital repayment thing. So the each year you pay your 2 or 3% fixed rate, and there's a minimum principal repayment over 30 years. But if you want to repay principal in advance, which most people do. You had that option. It's just that the principal component keeps on ramping up by inflation every year. So the sooner you pay it back, like you can still have almost exactly the same profile as the current variable rate mortgage if you repay it back early, and they seem to pay off over 3 or so years most of the time. Hopefully that answers the main component of your question.
A question from Elijah McCann. How might the inflation-linked mortgages impact the borrowers in later years of the mortgage being higher and being at a time of the financial life cycle where borrowers may have larger expenses such as children? Would this limit their ability to save or invest for retirement in other sources?
I mean, it's absolutely good question. Circumstances do change and children can be expensive. I guess the assessment at the outset is that in a real sense, you can pay that mortgage off. And as I was just saying, then, there's this scope to repay additional principal payments over time. So certainly in Australia at the moment, we see the vast, vast majority of mortgages repay principal ahead of the bare minimum for the mortgages. And so, yes, if somebody took it out while they were a couple or an individual without children, they might, one would expect them to start repaying some additional principal, and then potentially when they've got children, they can maybe cut back on their principal repayments or something like that. But yes, people ultimately shouldn't be taking out loans that they can't afford. I'm not sure that I subscribe to the idea that it's entirely the responsibility of the financial institution to determine that.
Thanks, Eric. Any other questions for the room? Okay, great. Well, I am going to ask whatever I feel like.
Great.
You've had a very interesting background across a lot of different areas. And I think most of us were actuaries here. What was your inspiration for the topic? What are some interesting stories that you can share with us that actuaries could learn from?
I've kind of just been, as I said earlier, interested in ways you can add value. I also got interested in the bright and shiny trading screen, so I initially left a consulting actuary role to become a swaps and options dealer for Bankers Trust. And that was really just to challenge myself and because of curiosity. But a few years later, I was consulting to Aussie Home Loans and RAMS and the major non-bank players brought an actuarial model, life insurance model, to value the books of business, basically as valuing the excess margin that they generate out of their books, which they weren't really doing at the time, and I was a bit surprised. Another 10 years beyond that, when somebody from one of the big accounting firms introduced it as a topic at one of these actuarial conferences, that they'd invented a new way of valuing mortgage books. But that one still irks me, obviously. I think the actuarial course is great for just such a broad range of skills that can be applied in lots of different circumstances. And really, I think I look at this sort of stuff and I think, why aren't people doing more? And I totally get it these days that people don't like change, and it's very hard to change things in the world because, status quo is a hard thing to fight. But I think there's also a problem that people are trained in this or they're trained in that, but they're not trained across different sort of areas, and they perhaps don't see the kind of synergies or possibilities that an actuary might see.
Well, appreciate the insight, Eric. We're at 12:40 now, so a round of applause for Eric Ransom.
Thank you.